Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds
It's Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Keith, here with co-host Gene DiNardo and Bill G, sitting in again for Jake Town. It is Thursday, September 27th, 2012, and here are the headlines we're looking at today. There's a lot of news coming out of Europe. We're going to be touching on a number of things regarding Spain and Greece, as well as what the EU and the IMF are doing about trying to stabilize the ever-continuing European financial crisis. We also have news from the British Bankers Association regarding LIBOR that we're going to be going over. Bill's got a report on Julian Assange speaking to the UN General Assembly by remote connection. Gene has a report on what's happening with the situation in Syria, which is deteriorating by the day. We're going to take a look at an article written by Ron Paul as part of his weekly pronouncements as his position as part of his position in Congress. We're also going to take a look, perhaps if we have time, at a private city being created in the city of Honduras. That's a really interesting one. But we're going to start off with the situation across the pond, so to speak. And we're going to look first at what's happening in Greece. Gene, you've been looking into that. What did you find out?
Greece is in the process of dealing with the banks and trying to get their loans pushed forward. I'll read a little bit from the article. They're basically pushing towards more austerity, and they're having some problems with that. The Greek political leaders have broadly agreed on a nearly 12 billion euro austerity package, despite reservations over wage and pension cuts, bringing Athens closer to a final deal on the plan. After weeks of haggling over the budget cuts, Prime Minister Antonis Samaras. His allies have struck a deal on the composition of the package and are moving, working out the final deal details of how salary and pension cuts will be spread out over the country. Nearly 70,000 Greeks marched to Parliament on Wednesday chanting EU IMF out in one of the biggest demonstrations yet against the cuts that threaten a new round of wage and pension cuts for tens of thousands. In the Greek population. This is putting pressure on coalition politicians, but the government is pressing ahead with steps to secure the next batch of bailout funds vital to keeping the state solvent. This is a basic agreement. We're moving forward to the final negotiations, Finance Minister Yanis Stornaris said after a meeting of the three leaders in Samaras' conservative-led government. Athens focused now shifts to clinching a deal with the troika of the European Commission, European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund lenders who return to Athens early next week to conclude talks on the package. The government needs to seal the deal soon so it can push the package through Parliament before an October meeting of Eurozone finance ministers. And then it has some about the overall deal. After the latest rounds of talks, Corvallis is from the Democratic Left Party. He acknowledged that the leaders still had to work through outstanding issues, he called them, but confirmed that a basic framework for a deal had been reached. In a bid to overcome differences, the leaders agreed to back spending cuts worth 10.5 billion euros instead of the previous goal of 11.5. So they're switching the goal there a little bit, making up the shortfall by raising targeted tax proceeds to 3 billion euros. They also agreed that Athens must demand the measures be spread over 4 years instead of two and seek guarantees that Greece's next round of aid worth over 31 billion euros will be paid out if the measures are backed by Parliament. So it's a kind of a tug of war between the Greek leaders, of course, want to push for the least amount of cuts to keep the people happy, and the banks want to push for the most and get the most out. You know, I saw another interview on this. I can't remember who it was, but it was a Greek economist, I believe. But he had a good point in that the bankers were pushing to make this as tough as possible as kind of an example for the rest of the European countries, so they just don't line up to get get another round of aid that, you know, they figure they have to make some cuts. But it's an interesting scenario, and it's kind of funny. The thing that came to my mind was we've always known that bankers and government's been kind of in collusion. But now here we have the bankers actually dictating to a government what they have to do, which is kind of interesting. You wonder who's actually in control.
What do you think, Bill? Who's in control over in the European Union? Is it the bankers or is it the government?
Yeah, the government.
definitely the bankers. And what I found also interesting is when this stuff was going on in the Parliament building, outside the Parliament building, there were thousands upon thousands of protesters, several of them throwing Molotov cocktails at riot police.
So they weren't happy about it. You know, the question I had in the article, and I should have done some further research, but maybe you guys know, they mentioned wage and pension cuts. Now, I'm just imagining that Greece has an incredible state workforce. I'm just imagining that's just the state workers. I mean, they can't possibly control the wages and the pensions of the private sector workers in Greece, can they?
No, you're right. It is mostly public employees who are involved there. The thing is that the public employees basically amount to a huge section of the overall workforce.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
so
the nature of
cut
the Greek
into their
system.
Wages, right?
Right, exactly.
Another point this Greek economist made was that, you know, I think Jake had brought up that number of times. We had talked about 50% of the youth or the people up to 30 are looking for or are unemployed. But what the guy explained, it's kind of a misleading statistic as usual because it's just counting the youth that are looking for work, as many of them are in school or very young. And, you know, it's still an amazing number, but it also doesn't count, as the interviewer brought up, it doesn't count those who have given up looking for work, just like the statistics here. But it is, he emphasized that it's not 50% of the population under 30, it's 50% of those looking for work. So, but it's still a terrible statistic. I mean, 50%.
You mentioned that the Greek officials are now trying to negotiate with the Troika, and in fact, Reuters had an article about that yesterday in which they reported that the Troika, now the Troika consists of the European Union, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund, and Reuters reported that the IMF and the European Union in particular are at loggerheads over how Greece should be reducing their debts further. European officials say the IMF is pushing them to restructure debts that Athens owes them, which is an uncomfortable prospect for some of Europe's leaders who find the idea of their governments taking losses on the debt politically unpalatable. The Greeks, of course, take a rather it's not us kind of position on it. One Greek official, according to the article, said the problem is not between the IMF and Athens, it's between the IMF and the EU. And that view was confirmed, according to Reuters, by sources familiar with the thinking in Brussels and Washington. So this may also be an in-house fight. And Bill, I'm going to turn to you on this one because of your particular knowledge of international financial matters. But how is such a fight likely to play out?
Well, it's likely to play out that the people who are getting their benefits cut more and more, and the unemployment keeps growing and growing, you're sowing the seeds for a revolution in Greece and in Spain. I mean, you can't increase taxes when people aren't working. I mean, you're not going to be increasing revenues if people aren't working, and then this is only going to further exacerbate the problem and make it even worse.
Yeah, I think that's true.
One of the things that's underreported in the Western media is how these radical groups are gaining popularity among the populace. In particular, you read RT News, which is the Russia Today, which is ironic considering the source there. But you read RT News, and you get the sense that the whole of Europe is on the verge of revolution.
Well, the other thing they mentioned, you mentioned taxes, and like the article said, they're pushing to try to collect more taxes. But the Greek government has an almost non-existent power to collect taxes, and it's been part of the problem in the past, is there's very, very low percentage of taxes that are actually collected among the population, and there's a huge black market. So even if they do push that through, it's kind of questionable whether they can actually get the taxes.
It's certainly been an ongoing series of riots there. I mean, the riots are not just the latest thing. They've been going on almost every single day for about the past year in Greece, and we're seeing them a lot more in Spain and Italy and so on and so forth. But particularly in Greece, it's just been, it's almost like that's what they do every day. They don't go to work, they go to the riots.
Yeah.
Sad, but true, you know. But the question that's still in my mind, I agree this is going to lead to revolution. I think it's going to lead to revolution no matter what. But I'm still curious, do you think that the IMF is going to win their fight to basically force Athens to capitulate on debts and force European sovereign states that are holding those debts, sovereign banks that are holding those debts to take another haircut, as they say? Or do you think the European Union leaders are going to win and the IMF is going to be driven back? My thought is that the IMF probably wins because they probably have the U.S. backing, but I don't know.
It's hard to tell because the more likely scenario is that Greece is just going to eventually get out of the euro because there's no way they can satisfy either one of those parties while staying in the euro.
Now, you know, that's a great point. If they actually had a strong production section in their country, which they don't, they're very weak on production, they could get out right now, I mean, and start printing their own money. I mean, the problem they have is they don't produce much, and since they don't produce much, you know, divorcing yourself from a strong currency puts you in very bad shape because you know your currency means very little to the rest of the world, and if you're not producing your own products, basically you just sit around and watch your currency go down and be devalued.
Particularly since their number one industry is tourism, and that's probably been almost completely wiped out by the fact that they're having these ongoing riots and ongoing struggles. So, I mean, the tourists aren't going to go there. They're not that stupid. At least I don't think so.
And you can also make the argument that the Greece is already starting to form their own currency in the form of their black market.
Exactly, yeah.
That's an interesting point. I can't say I have found a lot of information about that black market, but I know it must be there intuitively. It has to be. Have you seen actually any information about that?
No, I haven't actually.
I read an article, and it's very strong in Greece, and they don't have any idea what the percentage of the economy is, but it's high compared to most other countries, and it's the way a lot of them do business, which is part of the reason they can't collect taxes. They just can't track it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And by the way, USA Today, yesterday also, they were reporting on the protests in Greece, but they also were marking the protests in Spain because Spain is also going through more and more austerity measures. And in fact, earlier today, stocks advanced when they heard that the Spanish government said they were going to take even more action toward austerity cuts in the budget, and doubtless that will lead to even more violence and unrest in Spain. So if you read the financial pages, they're interpreting this as being a suspicion, I guess, or maybe even a hope that this will actually lead to Spain unraveling their financial mess. Personally, that sounds rather unrealistic to me, but it seems to be what the media are playing out. Bill, what have you been seeing from your side of the trading desk, so to speak?
Well, from my side of the trading desk, I saw that right after the Spanish government said that they were going to put more austerity through, the market started rallying. So
that's pretty much it.
Which is, you know, kind of odd because when you look at the pictures. And from Madrid, and you see thousands upon thousands of people on the streets being stormed by riot police, it's counterintuitive, except that the fact that the wealthy class who are putting all their all this new fiat money into assets are making out like bandits, and all this further austerity is just making them richer.
I don't really believe what I'm about to say, but I'll say it anyway. Is it possible that this is a surge by contrarian investors going on the old adage that the best time to invest is when blood is running in the streets?
Oh, gosh. The thing is that philosophy only really holds true if market's already down. But we're looking at an up market right now. So the only place where it can go is down. So it's again counterintuitive.
Mm. It does seem like the market is overvalued.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is when blood's in the street, when the markets are down, not when they're up.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And I think that's really the key point. I wanted you to elicit that, so thank you, because that really is the key thing. The markets aren't down. The markets are really quite insane right now. And I can't remember a time in history when they've been quite this insane on such a regular basis. That's probably the most striking thing from the market perspective anyway.
Well, yeah. the amount of fiat money out there, I don't think we have another time in history where the percentage was this high either, do we?
Exactly.
The percentage, sure. I mean, the physical amount, no. But the percentage, oh, yeah. I mean, you can just go back to any of the times of hyperinflation. You can find percentages that match this. But the sheer dollar amount, no. I don't think we have anything close to that.
Yeah, it's hard to measure. It'd be an impossible statistic to measure the impact, you know, the rate of fiat currency against just value, I guess, because there's so much to it, you know, how much product is out there. And like you say, the amount is up, right? But the amount of everything is up.
The closest historical example that I can think of is Argentina and the Weimar Republic. But again, we're not seeing those kind of numbers yet.
And that also is an interesting thing. I really believe that the numbers are there, but they're hidden.
Yes.
Because when you look at the numbers, the inflationary numbers in particular coming from the U.S., and I presume it's going to be very similar in other countries, particularly of the more developed types, those numbers are just not real. They can't be real. And we know that they're not real when we look at alternative measures. You go, for instance, to a site like shadowstats.com, which measures inflation the way it used to be measured, you know, 30 years ago, back when we were actually experiencing inflation or stagflation. And from their perspective, using the old style of measuring inflation, we have been experiencing at times double-digit inflation. And I suspect even that probably is understated, too. I guess the one thing that perhaps throws the fly into the ointment here is the fact that this isn't money printing in the sense of it coming off of a printing press. So it doesn't instantly circulate throughout the economy. And that's really the wild card in this, isn't it? I mean, the fact that we don't really know exactly when and where the money is flowing.
Yeah, but the money's ending up on balance sheets for Citigroup.
Yeah.
Yeah, next to their devalued mortgage-backed securities.
Exactly.
Which is the whole point of it. Now, I agree with you, Walt. I always watch building materials, and aside from lumber, which is pretty stable, basically because of demand has gone down, building materials have just shot through the roof in the last 4 or 5 years, and it's just counterintuitive. Because, well, at least for America, where the building has really, really slowed down, yet, you know, stuff like plywood is twice as expensive as it was just 5 years ago, and, you know, that's real inflation.
It's also important to point out that if you don't have an accurate series of measurements, if you don't have accurate numbers entering the economy, then what really ends up happening is people make decisions based on false information.
Mm-hmm.
They're making decisions based on being lied to. And perhaps that's the most disturbing thing about what's been going on. Maybe, Bill, maybe, Gene, that's the explanation about why people are buying at the time that we hear about the Spanish government undertaking more austerity measures. Maybe this is, in some cases anyway, really nothing more than people reacting to what they trust to be the numbers.
Well, the options the options people have, especially if you look at investing, is just basically very little now. I mean, the Fed has squeezed everything out of the bank. You know, the bank interests are so low, and really, this is what they're trying to do, as we've said many times, is just get it to where they can only do one thing: is spend the money, because it has no value to them, and they can't get any return on just storing it. And you know, it will eventually happen. I mean, people who do have money to spend, and I think that's the one reason the stock market goes up, regardless of what's happening in the economic scene.
That's where they're spending their money, in the stocks, and they're doing it in the bond markets. And what's also interesting is how the derivatives market is just going nutso. I mean, even a company that I work for, which is very, very conservative, has an extremely conservative investment portfolio is diving headfirst into derivatives.
Hmm. Interesting.
And what kinds of derivatives?
Credit default swaps and credit default indexes, options, and futures.
Wow.
Now, that is truly counterintuitive, considering everything we know about what has happened with credit default swaps, particularly in relation to the financial crisis of 2008. And here, a firm that, Bill, you described as a very conservative firm taking those kinds of stances. I this is an unfair question because you've already said you don't know why they're doing it, but why are they doing it?
They're doing it because they're afraid of a market crash.
Huh.
And how do they think
they are anticipating?
The
thing is, they're seeking what it's called in the financial world, seeking alpha. So, when you're seeking alpha, what you're doing is you're trying to get a higher return on interest on your investment portfolio with the U.S. Treasury rates at near zero. You're not getting any return for that investment. In fact, you're actually losing money when you buy government securities these days. So, in order to increase your alpha, you need to start buying securities which are higher risk. So your higher risk mortgage-backed securities, your corporate bonds, which on companies that are in a high-risk category, like oil exploration or commodities or that kind of thing. And because you are increasing your alpha, you're also increasing your risk. So in order to hedge that risk, you also have to purchase prodigious amounts of credit default swaps and other derivative products in order to hedge those purchases.
And yet surely they must know that's an insane strategy because that's exactly what led to 2008.
The only difference in 2008 is they were doing it because of there was so much return out there. Now, Bill is saying they're doing it because there's so little return, they have to find some place to put it. It is the same sort of investment. That's true.
And they've got to know about that. I mean, these people aren't stupid. These are very intelligent, well-educated, well-experienced traders making these very stupid decisions. How do they put the blinders in front of themselves? That's the part that I'm having trouble getting my head around.
Well, I grant you that these are very intelligent people. I mean, our investment team has done a tremendous job weathering us through the 2008 financial crisis. And the fact that they are making such a bold move so quickly towards the end of the year is informing me that they are pretty panicked about what the market is going to eventually do.
Wow. That's almost alarming. And I say that after having done this show for 2.5 years where we were talking about that this kind of thing is going to come at some point, that's alarming.
Yeah. So, Bill, do you think most traders feel the market is overvalued, or is it just a mixed lot where some feel it is, some don't? Some feel
I think it's a mixed lot, but I think the smarter ones know it's overvalued.
Hmm.
When you say that they are anticipating a crash, how big of a crash do you think they're anticipating? Are they talking about like a rather large correction, or are they talking about falling off the table?
That I don't know, because I talk to my investment team and they don't tell me this stuff.
You're not one of the in players.
I'll come on the show and talk about it.
Yeah, right. My God, he's going out telling our strategy. Oh, well, hey, you can't blame the guy for trying. Why not? Well, not only has this stuff been going on in Spain and Greece and apparently in Wall Street as a result of what's going on in Spain and Greece, but we also have rather interesting slash surprising news that came out of Britain this past week. Again, taking this from I believe it's a Reuters article, but I'm picking it up off of Yahoo. The article is entitled BBA Votes to Give Up LIBOR Roll. And we know, of course, that the LIBOR scandal has been quite an ongoing thing and continues to, I would say, even snowball, not just remain in place. Well, it turns out that the Council of the British Bankers Association has formally voted to give up its responsibility for setting the interbank borrowing rate, LIBOR, following the fixing scandal that engulfed the industry 3 months ago. Of course, it was more than 3 months ago, but that's all right. I have learned that at a BBA council meeting, the author says, on September 13th, a motion was passed for the organization to relinquish its role in the LIBOR administration process. The development, while not wholly unexpected, will effectively force regulators to devise a new structure for overseeing the benchmark rate, which has been sponsored by the BBA since the 1980s. The BBA had only hinted at such a decision since the rate rigging storm blew at the end of June, saying at the time, quote, the current LIBOR review with which our authorities are fully engaged has been underway since March this year and is considering all aspects, including the setting process. Of course, that's not true either because LIBOR has been under review for about a year and a half. As part of this review, it goes on to say, we will now be asking the authorities to consider in what manner the LIBOR setting mechanism should be regulated in the future. So, another interesting development in the LIBOR investigation. Bill, once more, I'm going to go to you and ask you, what has been Wall Street's reaction to this state of affairs? Is this anything new to them? Did they react to it, or is this just something they kind of ignored?
I think the Wall Street pretty much ignored that one, because I saw the article, and I saw that the market's not really reacting at all to it.
And that all by itself is an interesting fact, because LIBOR has so much of what's going on, and yet this is a key element, and they just don't seem to really, it's like they've already factored it in.
They've already factored it in. They've already pretty much written off the LIBOR as not being a reliable benchmark anymore, which it's kind of interesting. If the BBA isn't going to be doing the running the LIBOR anymore, who's going to do it?
Who is? Yes, indeed. And on top of that,
these rate mortgages just depend on it.
And plus, there are still trillions of dollars of these mortgages, like you said, that are still based on it. So if they're still based on it, how is it that that rate is no longer worthy of consideration? That's the part that surprises me. I don't see how you calculate that in and leave that as an incalculation when the people running the very rate structure that drives those mortgages are in such upheaval.
What is the process as far as when they set it? Do they meet periodically, or how does that work?
Well, they have a sandwich.
I believe it's done electronically.
Huh. So the computers are the ones that are fraudulent.
Yeah. It's all the computer's fault.
Take them to court.
This is the part that's just truly astonishing to me. I do get the concept of the markets pricing something in, but how on earth do you price something that very clearly has no predictable structure to it?
I don't know, and especially when the data that is used to create the LIBOR in the first place is questionable at best.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing is so completely counterintuitive that I'm not even sure where to begin to ask questions on something like this.
Well, if this stuff is written into
the toilet washing his hands, I mean, yeah. He was obviously responsible.
If the program is written into a computer, would they have fixed the fraud or the problem by now? I mean, how does that work? Or do they just keep the thing going until the court orders them to fix it, or?
Or pull a plug.
Pull the plug on the whole thing.
Garbage in, garbage out. But the thing is, though, it's not just a computer program. I mean, it's also interactions by various top-level players at the very largest banks, supposedly in the clean scenario, which doesn't exist, exchanging information with each other about what their current rates are for different levels of investment and lending. And the fact that process, which, as you were saying, Bill, is the basis for so many hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of mortgages, and that it's somehow factored out. How do you factor that out? I guess the only way I can conceive of that you can factor that out is if you already know what the resolution is going to be. And
yeah.
If you know what the resolution is going to be, then it implies to me very strongly a combination of central bank and sovereign intervention of some kind.
Which is probably what was going on in the first place.
Right, which means business as usual.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, every mortgage-backed security is influenced by it then also.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
But what it also means is that the financial crisis of 2008, which many people, not necessarily us listening and doing the show, but which many people, perhaps most people, have written off as being, you know, that part's done. Now we're in the news cycle. We're in the part where we're trying to get the economy going again. Well, not so much. Maybe it looks like that the financial crisis of 2008 is still going strong in 2012 and is about ready to get even worse.
Well, it is. The underlying structural aspects of it are still there. And I think, but most people, I think, pretty much ignore that aspect and just, you know, they're very practical. You have to be, you know, they're trying to earn a living. And they're looking around and noticing, you know, do people have more money than they have 4 years ago or 3 years ago? Are they spending more? You know, that's what people respond to. And this, you know, this plays right into the government and the system, the banking system, right into their hands, because that's what they want them to think. They want them to look at the economy, not to look deep and say, hey, you know, this isn't really right down here, and it still isn't right. And, you know, you have to look deeper to do that. And I don't think you can expect – it'd be nice if the average person did, but I don't think you can expect them to. I mean, they shouldn't have to.
Yeah, one wouldn't think so. Well, yeah. We're due for a break. Let's take a break, and then after the break, we can look at this a little bit further. Plus, we're going to take a look at Julian Assange talking to the UN General Assembly and a few other things after that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Just a reminder, you can always check out what's going on with the show and with the past shows in the archives by visiting www.freedomnewshour.com. You can also find the archives at prn.fm. And as mentioned before the break, Bill's been doing some checking into what's been going on at the General Assembly. Seems like everybody from Israel and Iran and the U.S. and various leaders around the world have been making addresses there. So I guess it's only fair that WikiLeaks gets to have their say. I guess that's probably the biggest news, that they let WikiLeaks speak at all, wouldn't you say, Bill?
Well, it is interesting. Actually, he didn't speak to the General Assembly. He spoke to the U.N. Council on Human Rights.
Okay.
Just as a clarification there. And he spoke for about 20 minutes, fielded some questions, and mostly what he was talking about is how the U.S. government and the Australian government and the U.K. government were unfairly characterizing WikiLeaks as, quote, the enemy, and how they continue to persecute not only him and his organization, but also his alleged sources as well. He mentioned, it's got me curious when I was just listening to his address, that not only Bradley Manning, who is famously jailed right now in a military prison without charge or trial at the moment, I think he's been in jail for now over 600 days due to his alleged leak to the WikiLeaks website, and now and he still has not been charged or put on trial yet, which is a violation of the military's own rules on these sort of things. But he also mentioned that he just leaked a document about one of his alleged informants, and this person wasn't. I don't believe this person actually was an informant, but it was someone that the military targeted, and. He didn't reveal the name of this person. This person was a female in the U.S. Armed in the Air Force, and apparently her only crime was attending Julian Assange's extradition hearing in the U.K. And at that point, that prompted an investigation, which went very deeply into this person's personal life. And when you read this thing, it blows your mind. And first of all, just the very summary of the report, the summary complaint is the charge is communicating with the enemy. So it's official that WikiLeaks is now the enemy of the United States. And the victims that they mention in the complaint report is society.
Wow.
Is there any word as to whether or not the U.S. Government or the military are going to file charges against the U.N. for communicating with the enemy?
Julian Assange. Now, are these
community?
Are these classified documents or are they just documents? Because I was under the impression
that came out was the Air Force investigative communication, which basically summarizes the case against this this female officer in the U.S. Air Force, and it's just amazing when you look through this thing. The word depression is mentioned about, you know, dozens of times. Apparently, this person they characterize this person as being severely depressed. So, you know, why else would you communicate with the enemy unless you're severely depressed? Let me see, that she had...
I'm going to have to watch that. If I ever start feeling depressed, I'm going to have to be very careful that my phone calls aren't being monitored.
Yeah. Let me see. Had numerous emotional breakdowns. Let's see. She had a liberal political views. Apparently,
that's illegal. That's got to be illegal.
In that case, I mean, let's just throw her in prison and forget about it. I mean,
yeah. I mean, she's described as being obsessed with Julian Assange.
Well.
They managed to get her commanding officer and other officers in the military to testify against her. But what's also interesting, this woman had top secret security clearance. You know, they established that. And there is also a page in here that actually goes through her computer records at the Air Force and tries to come up with some evidence that she actually leaked information to WikiLeaks. And their conclusion is that she didn't.
Hmm. But she still...
Is she charged with anything?
It was a leak.
Is she charged with anything, though?
She is charged with communicating with the enemy.
Communicating with the enemy.
Even though she didn't leak any information.
Even though she didn't leak any information. What's also interesting, there's... On pages 2 and 3 of this report, it goes into detail on how nothing was leaked, but the summary and conclusions are blacked out as classified.
How much detail do you have to put into that something didn't happen?
Yeah, well,
apparently a lot.
I mean, hey, guys, I can make this real simple. It didn't happen. End of paper. We're done.
Yeah. Let's move on here.
There was no evidence that she actually leaked any information, and her real crime was attending the extradition hearing, which is apparently against the rules.
But she got in.
She also had a Twitter account where she subscribed to Julian Assange's Twitter account, which is also a crime in the military.
A crime if you're in the military.
It's a crime if you're in the military to visit WikiLeaks or to even listen or meet with anyone who is sympathetic to WikiLeaks.
Oh, man.
Well, I guess we don't have anybody in the military listening to our program.
I don't know.
Hey, guys, if you're in the military and you're listening, you better turn off because I don't want you guys to end up in the pokey.
That's actually a very real possibility. Anybody I think people in the military don't listen to the Progressive Radio Network in general
they could be. I mean, if it's on their computer, it's they can look that up.
Monitor, yes.
Maybe they listen to WorldNet Daily instead. I mean, it's a nice, safe, conservative.
Well, are they allowed to listen to Fox News?
Oh, I'm sure they are.
That's the problem.
And that's a really interesting thing right there, because what this really comes down to is, and as anyone who's listened to the show knows, I mean, Gene and I are libertarian. Bill, you're pretty much in the middle of moderate or a centrist or whatever you want to call it. So none of us fit into the liberal camp, although we're on what would be considered a liberal radio network. And I think we would all pretty much agree that despite that fact, this is one case where we're on the side of the liberals and looking at the conservatives and say, what the heck is wrong with you guys?
I don't think it's a rare case.
On the PRN as being maybe left of center, but still, it's I think it's pretty much on the money, a lot of that stuff anyway.
I don't see any reason why PRN wouldn't like our show, to tell you the truth. I mean, I think the libertarian outlook is very liberal, but it doesn't use the same solutions as liberals do.
Well, clearly, yeah. they don't dislike it because they haven't kicked us off after 2.5 years. So
yeah, that's exactly.
Well, are they listening to this one? Uh-oh.
And it's not like they haven't had ample opportunity to do it. I mean, we've taken plenty of pot shots at liberals over the years here, but they still haven't kicked us off. No, to me, the point here is that as you guys were describing, the only thing that the military apparently are allowed to listen to is conservative media.
Yes.
That's very disturbing.
Can they listen to MSNBC? Or what is
it? Let me see if I can pull up the...
Because that's a good question. That would definitely show that it's got a conservative...
Showing any sympathy to Bradley Manning is strictly forbidden. Let me see. It's in here someplace where it is strictly forbidden to look at these websites, to open Twitter accounts under aliases and listen to these and get any of this information. And if they're found out, they can be charged. And if they actually engage in meeting with people who are sympathetic to that, they can be charged with fraternizing with the enemy.
Interesting.
That's really very, very disturbing.
Well, it's a very wartime outlook. I mean, through all our wars, every war it goes that direction.
Yeah. And Julian Assange was making the point that we are a media outlet, and we are trying to engage in simply bringing out the truth in however way we see fit. And it's very disingenuous for Barack Obama to address the General Assembly saying that, freedom of the press is one of the pillars of democracy, and then to turn around and be one of the most aggressively anti-free speech presidents we've ever had since Abraham Lincoln.
Well, yeah, if he was going to be straightforward, he would have said the same thing he said about the movie, the Muhammad movie. He would have said, we have freedom of speech, WikiLeaks is part of that, yet I don't agree with it. I mean, it's a personal opinion rather than taking a stance with the force of the government against it.
Well, whatever way you want to look at it, I can tell you this. It's looking very much like we're going to have another 4 years of President Obama unless something shifts dramatically in the presidential election race. So we better be prepared because this is going to be ongoing.
Romney wouldn't be any better.
Oh, I think no, Romney would be far worse.
Absolutely, I agree with you. I'm just pointing out that's where we're going.
Yeah, which we predicted, didn't we, Walt, way back?
Yeah, actually, yes. I think we did. Yeah.
I think all three of us did.
I listened to that show.
Yeah. Yeah, we won. Well, things can change in a month, but it
is also lost, but that's beside the point.
Carolyn Baum wrote a very good op-ed today on Bloomberg saying that unless there's an October surprise, Romney's done.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely done. I mean, you look at the polling data, and it's close, but it's all leaning toward Obama. I mean, it's not really much of an election left at this point. Again, there's a month left, so anything can happen, but...
It'd have to be a big anything.
Well, there's a month for Romney to say more stupid things.
Well, yeah, it's going to have to be something that comes from outside the Romney campaign, because clearly the Romney campaign is incapable of moving the electorate by themselves. So it's going to have to be like the crash we talked about happening before the election rather than afterward, or some sort of major disaster hitting the U.S. and the Obama administration does a bad job, like Bush and New Orleans or something like that.
Yeah, and the likelihood of that happening are very, very low.
Very low, yeah.
The Obama administration is controlling the message right now. I mean, all the news on the major media outlets is, I guarantee you, it's the State Department controlling the message. Because you go outside outside Western media, it's a whole different story.
Yep.
Yeah, that could be, right?
Well, Bill, I know you have to leave a little bit early here, but thank you for that report. Very interesting on Assange and the implications of his address to the U.N.
Thank you very much. I'll see you guys later.
Okay.
All right. You have a great week.
All right. You too.
Well, on the subject of government oppression, Gene, you've been doing some research as to what's been going on with the Syrian situation, which is deteriorating daily. What have you found out?
Yeah, Syria is a big mess, and it's getting worse. There is a good article on it, so I'll read some from it. It says up to 700,000 refugees may flee Syria by the end of the year, the United Nations Refugee Agency said on Thursday. They're all trying to escape a conflict which is killing hundreds every day and dividing world powers at the United Nations as to what they should do or if they should do anything. The UN forecast is almost four times higher than its June prediction, which reflects the spiraling violence in Syria, where President Bashar al-Assad has responded to rebel military gains with airstrikes and artillery bombardment, and he's been criticized of basically bombing his own population. Activists said more than 300 people were killed in Syria on Wednesday, including dozens in a town southeast of Damascus, where they accused Assad's forces of committing a massacre. Rebels also bombed the military staff headquarters in the capital. Around almost 300,000 refugees escaping 18 months of conflict have crossed into neighboring Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Turkey, most of them in the last 2 months. There's a significant outflow taking place, 100,000 people in August, 60,000 in September, and at the moment 2,000 or 3,000 per day. That came from the regional refugee coordinator for the United Nations. The flow of refugees surged in August when Assad deployed jets and helicopters to strike rebel-held towns in the northern provinces of Aleppo and Idlib, sending thousands across the border into Turkey. Heavy military clashes with rebels in Daraa in the south also drove many Syrians into neighboring Jordan, so they're basically going to the nearest border. Since the uprising against Assad erupted in March last year, more than 30,000 people have been killed. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said that last week. It said more than 7,000 of those were soldiers and members of the security forces. The United Nations says many, many more have been displaced, and that 2.5 million people in the country need aid and assistance. Many of the world leaders, including the Turks, I saw a Turkish ambassador who basically was saying that he was ready to go, or the country of Turkey was ready to go at any time the United Nations was ready to take action. And many of the world leaders are criticizing the United Nations. They want more action. Of course, some don't want more action. But Qatar, one of the several Sunni Muslim powers which supports the rebels, called for a no-fly zone to provide a safe haven inside Syria. French President Francois Hollande also called on the United Nations to protect what he called liberated zones under rebel control. Western powers have shied away from supplying military aid to rebels, who include foreign jihadists, and there is little chance of securing a Security Council mandate for such action, given the opposition of veto-wielding members Russia and China, who both are against it. There was a Chinese quote here. See if I can. Okay, China's Foreign Minister Yang Heqi, I probably pronounced it wrong, said the destiny of the region should be held in the hands of its own people. Egypt's Islamist President Mohamed
Morsi. I'm sorry, I think I'm laugh at that.
What's that?
We'll consider what the source is.
Yeah, right. Exactly. like they don't control them. Egyptian's Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last month called on the world to stand against Assad's oppressive regime, said his country opposed foreign military intervention to halt the fighting. So there's various opinions on the subject, but anyway, it is a mess, and it's a terrible situation with like was mentioned, they're bombing their own people, and it's just probably one of the worst situations in the Middle East right now.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't show any signs of stabilizing. That's probably the scariest part of all, unfortunately. But thank you for the report. I think we have to do something to kind of uplift things a little bit, so I'm going to talk about a couple of reports, one from actually 10 days ago that I wanted to discuss last week's show, but we just ran out of time, so I'll mention it here. I can't say this is great, but this is at least something in the right direction. Comes from the UK, and it's a headline that says, controversial naked airport body scanners to be scrapped after failing to receive European approval. Of course, we know what we're talking about here. We're talking about those wonderful body scans that the TSA loves to use here in this country. Well, not so much in Europe. The last remaining full-body X-ray airport scanners are to be scrapped within weeks. The security systems, which have been tested at airport terminals since 2009, scan through passengers' clothes, creating a detailed ghost-like image of the naked body. The scan is then viewed by security staff. Critics said the machines invaded passengers' privacy and the radiation they generate raised the risk of cancer. Some Muslim groups also refused to walk through them on religious grounds. The European Commission ruled that the cancer risk was close to zero, but under Brussels legislation, the three-year trial period has elapsed, and it has decided not to, quote, prioritize, unquote, them for permanent use across the continent. Airport bosses who were waiting for the green light on the machines now say they have been left with no option but to remove them. Interesting development. Wouldn't it be nice if we had a development like that here in the U.S.? I can't say that it looks like there were cooler heads prevailing or smart wisdom involved. It looks like it was just bureaucrats kind of giving into the inevitable, but still in the right direction.
Yeah, we're installing them like crazy. Like I think I mentioned the Portland Airport has one. But that reminds me of a Yogi Bear quote, a different one than I gave you over the email there, Walt. apparently, it was fairly common in the old days before they had security in the baseball stadiums for people to flash, run naked across the field. And this happened about a game Yogi Bear was catching, and they asked him who ran across the field? Were they men and women? He said, I don't know. They had bags over their heads.
That's a Berra quote. No doubt about it. A Berraism.
Yeah, the quote that, for the listeners, the quote that the other quote was an economic quote by Yogi Berra, and it was, a nickel isn't worth a dime anymore. James Yep. Bordar's show.
Gotta love Yogi. He's a wonderful old guy. One last news report. This one coming from, well, that much maligned Fox News that we were mentioning earlier, but they actually have something of interest here. A report that was dated the 22nd entitled Private City in Honduras Will Have Minimal Taxes in Government. And I'll just read a little bit from this article. Small government and free market capitalism are about to get put to the test in Honduras, where the government has agreed to let an investment group build an experimental city with no taxes on income, capital gains, or sales. Proponents say the tiny, as yet unnamed town will become a Central American beacon of job creation and investment by combining secure property rights with minimal government interference. Quote, once we provide a sound legal system within which to do business, the whole job creation machine, the miracle of capitalism, will get going, unquote. Michael Strong, CEO of the MKG Group, which will build the city and set its laws, told FoxNews.com. Strong said that the agreement with the Honduran government states that the only tax will be on property. And that's where I stopped reading.
That's where you stopped reading. Now, I'm actually on an email blog with him. I think Michael is one of the owners of Whole Foods originally, and the question I had out of, they were going to put in $15 million worth of infrastructure like a government would, and this was being done by him, I guess, or his whatever foundation they're putting together. I was kind of interested how they would get that back. It's the only taxes on, I believe the property tax is going to the Honduran government, but I don't know for sure.
And that's why I stopped reading, because I said to myself, okay, Honduras is dirt poor. And that government, if they've got themselves a nice, hefty asset to tax, they're going to try to tax it.
They're going to tax it.
If they got only one way to tax it, and that's through property taxes, why should we believe that they are not going to impose confiscatory property tax rates?
Apparently they said that there's no way they would let of course they pushed for no taxes originally, and the government said no, there's no way we're going to do that. But yeah, this is a Central American government. Honduras is somewhere in the middle as far as it's pushed towards the hard right, government control, right? And I agree with you. I mean, who knows down the line once they got millions invested, who knows what's going to happen with the government. What action they'll take.
We could also argue, though, what happens when you've got all of these people living outside of the city seeing some prosperity going on there? I mean, first of all, that becomes the job haven. That's where everybody goes for their job.
Yep.
And then secondly, I would think that at some point they want some kind of pressure put on the government to expand the boundaries of that city. And if that happens, when does Honduras disappear and that new city becomes the new island?
Exactly, and do you let, what are they going to do? Are they going to wall this little city, or are they, all these Central American cities, people pour in, and that's how the favelas get built up, is they have, they end up not getting a job. Some of them do, but a lot of them don't, and they build the little cardboard shack neighborhoods outside the town, and so what kind of action are these people going to take, or pushing towards freedom, yet when everybody starts pouring in, what do you start limiting, that freedom, or...
We'll have to just leave it there as the positive note that something is happening that has at least a chance of being good. We'll kind of leave it at that, because we're out of time, unfortunately. But, Gene, as usual, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, Walt.
And we will see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
The tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. It's finally the tables are starting to turn, talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution. Oh, no. Talking about a revolution.